Welcome to Transition State.
I'm Sports Drive here on NPR, and we have a 20-minute field recording of a tumluku, which is a Bosnian instrument which can only be played when you have a pierced scrotum and three kids who have been killed by a landmine. It's unlistenable radio! You understand me?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Totally listenable radio.
Let me refresh your memory. Russians. That's right. Russians. Ruskies. Communists. Communists. Oh, now you remember.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Russian Tim, and I'm the host of weekly punk rock radio show called Rocket from Russia. Every Tuesday, 10:30 to 11:30 a.m., Rocket from Russia is aired on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, or CITR.ca, anywhere where internet is paid for.
Check my mic 1, 2. Welcome, radio fans. You're listening to Transition State on CITR 101.9. I'm your host, as always. And with me, as for the very first time, is Fungal Lab research scientist extraordinaire, Miss Jacqueline D. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Adam.
How's it going?
Great.
Got the mic on?
I think so.
Okay. We are going to talk some hard science later, but for now, I just want to introduce you to my listeners. So can you maybe tell them a bit about who you are, what you do in the research community?
Okay, so I'm a PhD student in the lab of Dr. Mary Burby. I've been working on my PhD now for, this is my fifth year. I have been working on this kind of research or related research for a good maybe 8 to 10 years now, actually. I started during my undergrad. And I still really enjoy it.
8 to 10 years? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Then let's go back that 10 years. Do you remember, like, what was it? What was it that got you interested in doing science?
So while I was an undergraduate, I took a course in fungal biology as well as algal and bryophyte biology. So bryophytes include mosses and these plants called the liverworts.
Okay.
And I just found myself really captivated by this group of organisms that were so diverse and so important and yet really understudied. And I thought that there were a lot of really interesting biological questions that hadn't been tackled yet.
Okay. Okay. That's interesting. I mean, okay, I have to stop. Okay. Bryophytes are mosses.
So it's an artificial grouping that includes mosses and this kind of plant that's called a liverwort, and yeah, also these other plants called hornworts.
So I'm imagining you as like an undergrad student,
yeah,
and you're like, most people when they hear words like that, they think, oh, biology, why do you hurt my soul? But you hear that and you're like, ooh, cool.
Yeah. No, I've always been really interested in sort of unusual underdog type things. And
okay,
when it came to biology, to kind of, you know, push aside, well, yeah, cat skeletons look the same as bat skeletons look the same as, you know, things that are vertebrates, often they're just kind of the same pattern over and over. But in organisms like fungi and so-called lower plants, there's a lot more variety and a lot more strategies that they've come up with to survive. They just do things that are really different and really sort of ingenious.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm tempted just to start talking about the hard science right now then.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, on that tree of life is, okay, first of all, it's fungi, not fungi.
There's no official.
It's either one.
Yeah. It's whatever you prefer.
I've heard fungi. I'm going to say fungi.
Yeah. I mean, fungi is what my boss says. And so having spent many years with her, that's kind of what I've adopted. But it's much more fun to say fungi because then there's a lot more puns and terrible jokes that you can make.
That's
really important after all.
Okay.
But it's just force of habit from being around people who say fungi a lot.
Okay.
But there's no real reason that you should say one or the other.
A little bit
in common practice.
There.
Okay. There's probably a technically correct way of saying it because it's derived from, you know, Latin and whatnot, but In the community, everyone says different stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Then here's my first question. Is a mushroom a type of fungi, or is a fungi a type of mushroom?
A mushroom is a type of fungus.
Okay.
Yes.
And a fungus is a type of eukaryote?
Yes.
Eukaryote meaning true cells. So those are like the big things, including all mammals.
Yes.
Eukaryotes is three main divisions, which is plants, animals, and fungi.
Yes.
So fungi is huge.
Yes, it's a huge, huge group.
Okay. Do they really deserve their own huge thing?
Oh, yes.
Really?
I mean, all the plants,
all the animals, and all the fungi? See, like, all the animals from the ocean up, mammals.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let alone people.
And you're not even, those are all the things that are multicellular.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of diversity of things that are all unicellular, in fact. And there's the Tree of Life. I don't know if you've got it on this poster here that you recently purchased.
For our listeners who don't know, I just purchased a Tree of Life poster.
Yeah.
It's rolled up now. I'm tempted to take a look at it.
I think you should unfurl it with great flourish.
Okay.
So that we can gaze upon it. Because, yeah, no, it's amazing. And I don't know. Yeah, I haven't seen it. So there might be a lot of unicellular things that are depicted in that poster, but maybe not. But,
okay.
I mean, if you were to look at sort of an updated Tree of Life at the moment, there's a really great website, the Tree of Life website, that a lot of researchers here in our community at UBC contributed to.
What's the website? Treeoflife.com?
It's ATOL, ATOL.org. org or something like that.
ATOL?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That sounds cool.
Yeah. So
okay.
It's just an amazing repository of information about organisms that, you know, a lot of people never even think about. But, you know, in a drop of pond water, there's hundreds of them. And,
right.
You know, it just, you know, pond water, the guts of various things like sea urchins and
The guts of
termites is a really diverse place that
people here
in the department
termites
have studied.
Microorganisms doing their digestion.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And sea urchins have guts?
Oh, yes.
They look like they are guts.
Not the outside. They've got that spiny exoskeleton.
Okay.
But they do have guts. We had a graduate student in our lab a couple of years ago who discovered this whole group of organisms that...
Really?
Yeah. I mean, she didn't discover the whole group, but she was able to kind of reorganize some pre-existing organisms based on that one that she had just – she was doing some just straight-up discovery science by looking at sea urchin guts, dissecting them out, and trying to just culture things out of them. And she found this really cool thing that it's called Creolimax.
Creolimax.
It gives birth to slugs. And yeah, it's a real organism.
Creolimax?
Yeah, so it's something that's actually sort of
giving birth to slugs.
Yes.
This is the most educational episode ever. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Wow, I can't believe so our listeners might not know, but I met Jackie by volunteering at that fungal lab.
Yes.
But I never got to make a cool discovery like that.
Yeah.
I just had to do DNA polymerase chain reactions?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah. But that's a huge part of that research that she did. So, I mean, what you did was exactly what this person with was doing to do this work. Yeah.
Okay. I want to get back to the fungal and the Tree of Life because I feel like that's really overrepresenting the importance of fungi to have them equal with all the plants that have ever existed. And everything else, every animal, every fish, and human and primate and mammal, and you think fungi are right up there with that huge class? I feel like fungi should be a small little blip.
No.
They're only a tiny piece. What other? There's mushrooms?
So there's mushrooms and there's molds. And the kind of fungi that I work on are sort of popularly termed the water molds. They're actually swimming fungi. So... things like mushrooms and molds have spores for reproduction that are dispersed by air. But the fact is there's a lot of fungi that are actually also dispersed through water because they can swim, like a sperm.
They can swim. They can be pushed around the water by the flow, or they can swim?
They can swim. So, yes, the flow of water is a thing.
They have a flagella?
But they also have a flagellum. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, that actually is amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, so, though, regarding your thing about the plants and the animals being these really big groups, and I think part of the really interesting thing about that that you mentioned is that actually for every – it was estimated that for every plant there are six fungi.
That it cannot be true.
Yeah.
Do you know how many plants there are? All the ferns and trees?
Yeah.
There are six times that many fungi.
Yes.
The world would be overrun.
Yes, and that's probably an underestimate because since then, when that person made that, so this scientist named David Hawksworth, he made an estimate years and years ago, I can't remember when, but he estimated that there were 1.5 million species of fungi and that we actually, between then and now, we've only discovered, I think, and named about 10,000 more. So we're really under studying what is a very diverse group of organisms. And like I said, that's an underestimate because at that time they didn't even know about this group of fungi called endophytes. And endophytes are fungi that live in plants undetectable, except unless you use just genetic screens. So if you go out into the environment and you collect the samples and you crush them up and you extract their DNA, then you can find these things, but they don't show – they never show up on the surface of the plants or anything like that, so you wouldn't even know that they were there.
Other than you found traces of their DNA.
Yes.
Are you sure, though? Like, now that we know.
But now you can
there,
culture some of them, but not all of them are culturable. Yeah.
I can't even fathom what that means. They're there, but they're undetectable.
Yeah. So.
Are you sure they're there?
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe.
So if you sterilize the outside of a leaf, say.
Yeah.
You know, you've effectively killed everything that's living on the outside of it. But what you can do then is you can still then crush up that leaf. And, of course, there's going to be the leaf's DNA, and then there's going to be bacteria. But there's actually also a lot of fungi that are living inside that leaf.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's a question for you. Is there any way that you think fungi are superior to eukaryotes? I mean, to, like, animals? What's the animal one called?
So, the animal one?
Like, there's the kingdom that we're all eukaryotes.
Oh, yes.
Like plantae. Is that right?
Right.
And what's the animal one?
So there's metazoa.
Metazoa.
Yeah.
So can you think of any way in which the fungi are superior to metazoa?
I wouldn't go about saying any organism is superior to anything else. Every organism is adapted to its own environment.
Okay.
So,
okay, I get
you know,
that.
As good as you are at being a radio host and a student, you know, there's a single-celled organism that's good at chasing around bacteria and eating them for a living.
Fungi do that?
Fungi don't. Okay, so that's a really important fundamental difference between fungi and animals. So animals eat essentially by putting food into their bodies and then secreting digestive enzymes around their food, breaking it down, and then absorbing the nutrients. Fungi eat by basically, it's kind of analogous as if you took your stomach and you everted it.
Okay.
So you spilled all your digestive enzymes outside of your body.
Yeah.
And then did all the digestion externally and then were able to.
And then you ate it.
Yeah, basically absorb the nutrients through your digestive, or through your absorptive cells, like you're in your small intestine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
how
something.
Fungi eat. They get into their food and on their food, and they secrete digestive enzymes all around it, and then they break up. They eat what is all broken down.
Okay.
Because they actually have a cell wall around them, and so they can't bend around things, so they have to sort of work around that by making everything really small before they absorb it.
Okay, that's one thing they have that I don't have.
Yeah.
All right. Jeez. Oh, I had a question, but now I lost it. That's so interesting.
Yes.
So when we talk about fungi, we're talking about multicellular organisms?
So not all fungi are multicellular. The ones that we're familiar with, mushrooms and molds, are indeed multicellular. But yeast, for example, that are really important.
Is that a fungi?
Yeah, that's a fungus.
Okay.
So every single
that's
listener
huge.
Out there, you know, probably has encountered the yeast in
absolutely.
Their...
Absolutely.
In their daily...
Fermentation.
Exactly.
Okay.
Bread making, beer, all that stuff. Fungi.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, I'm starting to warm up to this.
Yeah.
Do fungi reproduce sexually?
They do.
How could that possibly be?
So...
Are there boys and girls fungi?
Yeah, so there are in some cases. So that's another thing that really sets them apart from a lot of, for example, animals. There are males and females, and well, maybe there are hermaphrodites. But in fungi, there's just a whole slew of different mating strategies. And in some cases, there are male and female. And things that are classified as female in fungi are generally those that house offspring. So what is defined as a female in a fungus is the partner in reproduction that will take care of the offspring or that contributes more material to it. So equal amounts of genetic material from both parents, but the mother provides more like cytoplasm, so more of the nutrients, all the parts of the cell parts that are needed for the offspring.
Do they mate? Do they like?
Yeah.
How do they find?
So that's a really important area of research that a lot of people are really interested in. So they mate by producing pheromones, or they will basically they find each other by producing pheromones. So you can imagine something like mushrooms, mm-hmm. for example, that live in the soil. Would produce. So, I mean, what you see above ground is this mushroom, but what you have to realize is actually underground, there's the whole body of it. So the mushroom is just one part of a whole body.
Mycelium.
The mycelium. Exactly.
Okay.
You remembered something.
Got it.
Excellent. Super. So the mycelium being the whole thread-like body of a fungus that is basically modified for reproduction and various other things. So the mushroom is just the reproductive part of the whole mycelium that's assimilating nutrients and breaking things down and doing all the ecological functions that mushrooms do, forming mycorrhizal partnerships. That's a really significant ecological role that fungi have.
The questions are coming too fast. What's mycorrhizal relationship?
So mycorrhizae are these symbiotic relationships between plant roots and fungi.
Plant roots, rhizomes, fungi, mycorrhizal.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
That makes sense.
So fungus root. So what that is fungi living in really close association with plant roots. And what happens there is that fungi provide the plant with nutrients that are generally limited in the environment. So things like nitrogen and phosphorus are generally limiting factors for the growth of plants in the environment. And what fungi can do is essentially by interacting with these roots, they're functionally extending the network over which the plant can gather nutrients, such as nitrogen and phosphorus. So ordinarily, the plant roots can grow out to, you know, whatever radius from the plant that they can grow. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine that, you know, if you wanted to say, if you were, I don't know, this is kind of, I'm really bad with analogies.
Lay it on me, lay it on
I'm
me.
I'm horrible with analogies.
That's okay.
All the time when I'm
it.
Teaching.
I want to hear it.
People are looking at me like, you're crazy. if there was somebody, if one of our friends fell off a cliff.
Yep.
And I was at the top of the cliff, mm-hmm. and we wanted to reach that person, but I couldn't quite reach them.
Mm-hmm.
I might link hands with you. Human chain, basically. And you would grab that person's hand. So basically functionally extending my reach out so that we can save that other person. And that's what the fungi are doing with the root, is they're basically just expanding the reach of the root. So it's just providing a passage for nutrients from the soil to the plant, to where, because the plant can only extend itself so far,
mm-hmm.
But the fungus, the fungal mycelium can grow quite a bit farther, faster, and they're smaller, so they can kind of get.
So the tree or the plant's roots get extended.
Yes.
It's like distribution, and what did the fungi get?
So the fungi get in return, they get photosynthates. So they get sugars from photosynthesis from the plant.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good deal.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, thank you for clarifying that, but I got to go back to where you said that.
Sure.
You said that the mycelium sort of under the soil is the real body.
Yes.
And the mushrooms that we see popping out of the floor are the parts that do the reproduction?
Yeah. So they're just there to disperse spores, actually.
Do you think of them as, like, sexual organs?
No. So they're not sexual organs in the sense that they're involved in, like, copulation and then actual exchange of genetic material. They're involved in reproductions as in so far that, it's analogous, like, if after people had babies, they yeah. went and put them in a basket and, like, with holes in it and threw it all over the place.
That's the mushroom's job?
Okay. Yeah, I'm okay. awful with analogies. It's really just about dispersing offspring that have already been created.
Okay.
It's not – the mushroom doesn't have anything to do with actually creating the offspring itself.
Okay.
Themselves. Yeah. So not like sex organs where you actually – you know, they meet and they produce some kind of gamete. And then you get, exchange of genetic material at that point. But it's really sort of after the fact.
Okay.
You're just involved in dispersal.
Okay. And going back even before that, when fungi reproduce sexually, if I had a microscope, you could see, like, them kind of, you say you have them on the same slide, and then they kind of, like, ooh, check each other out.
Yeah.
And then they start moving towards.
Yeah.
And then... Then what?
Then they'll fuse. So to the mycelium.
Right down to business. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a little bit of like, hey, cutie, with the pheromones, and
are
then
you
hey, you.
Me?
Yeah.
That blows my mind that would yeah. happen on like the cellular level.
Yeah. So a lot of research goes into figuring out how they do. So it's really good that you came up with that question because, in fact, I mean, I don't do that kind of research, but there's a ton of people out there in our field who are really interested in questions of how they reproduce because in biology, we're all about sex.
Hey, okay.
Yeah.
The science of life. Okay.
The science of life.
Okay. I want to ask you about the work that you've been doing on research.
Okay.
So first of all, what's it like being a research scientist? Is it awesome? It seems
like
it would be very cool.
It is. It's like any other job in the sense that I think there are super awesome times and there are really draggy times.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I mean, it's super awesome. I mean, the best thing about my work is that, I mean, I get to make discoveries. I get to see things that people have never seen that no one could have imagined. And you're the first person who gets to see it and you're the person who gets to share it with everyone else. And that's a really spectacular thing to be able to do. Yes, I have.
Lay it on me.
So let's see. There's this group. So I was telling you about how things like mushrooms and molds are multicellular and the sort of underlying structure of that or how that sort of manifests is fungal cells in those kinds of organisms generally are in the shape of tubes or threads, so like really long, thin tubes. So it's like cells, like beads on a string, essentially, like one after the other,
okay,
all strung together.
Does that make bacillus?
So that has to do with bacteria.
Okay.
So a bacillus is just a rod-shaped
bacterium. This is
yeah.
Okay.
So this is fungi, and the terminology is different.
Okay.
Yeah. But this kind of structure, wherein cells are produced sort of in a thread, are called hyphae.
Okay.
So the cells. In a fungus like a mold or a mushroom are called hyphae. And that is a structure that is actually not found in, for example, the fungi that I was telling you about, these swimming fungi. So they tend to actually produce a globe-shaped body that just has these like little rhizoids, which are just sort of are root-like, but they're sort of just, they can be continuous with the whole reproductive body. So it's basically in the swimming fungi, the body is in large part, most of the organ, not all. So that's why I'm doing this research. There's just a huge amount of diversity. But one of the very common forms is that there's just this sort of globe, which is, kind of looks like, you can imagine it's like a gumball machine. So inside of the gumball machine, there are these little round things, and those are actually the spores that are meant for reproduction.
Okay.
And those are flagellated.
Mm-hmm.
And if you imagine that gumball machine, instead of having like a base where you'd put that quarter and the little turn dial,
yeah.
you had a bunch of like little root-like things.
Okay.
That's what this looks like.
It sounds like an alien.
It does sound. It looks and sounds like an alien.
Wow.
Yeah. No. And but this is real life. This is.
And you discovered
what I work
that?
On. Oh, I didn't discover that. No, no. People. I mean, as soon as there were microscopes, people saw these things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What did you discover?
So what I discovered was that. So while there's a lot of structures like the ones that I was describing, there are actually a few rare examples of fungi in the group that are actually like. In structure, the molds in the mushrooms, so they actually produce hyphae as well. So they're very different from their close relatives. And I was curious as to whether the hyphae in that group had evolved separately from the hyphae in molds and mushrooms, or if they were from the ancestor. So if the first fungi were all hyphal. But then some had changed into this other form that I was describing.
Mm-hmm.
And this group that I was looking at had just retained that form of hyphae, or whether they had evolved it separately. And the answer was that they evolved it separately. So we've got basically different groups through time converging on the same sort of overall body form.
Okay.
Yeah. So
instead Tree of life stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, so not diverging.
So they're diverging. So groups that had diverged through evolutionary time,
yep.
So speciation,
yep.
All that stuff occurring, they ended up. So even though they had, you know, what they probably found different niches to live in, and so they started to adapt to those. But over time, one of the groups started to develop a hypha, like its relatives that are much more distant because their ancestors diverged a long time ago.
So they didn't inherit it from them. They
no,
made it on their
they
own.
Made it on their own.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when did that happen? Like a trillion years ago?
Oh, no, not a trillion. So
a zillion?
About probably 400 million years ago.
Okay. Now I have to ask, how could you possibly know that?
So,
how can you have any idea what happened 400 million years
yes,
ago?
Yes, that's a great question. So what we have, there's different ways where we can use to study things that happened a long time ago that we can't possibly have seen. One of them is with fossils. So
okay.
There are actually really, 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 really old fungi that were preserved
through time. Like under
Antarctica? No, actually, in this thing called Rhynie Chert.
Rhynie Chert?
So there's this place in Scotland called Rhynie.
Okay.
And don't ask me how these things were formed because I really don't know. I'm not a geologist. But this kind of, I think it's a silicon-based, related to glass and silica and things like that. Or quartz. Sorry, it's quartz. It's quartz.
Fungi.
No. So the formation of quartz around these fungi preserved them.
Oh, okay.
Essentially.
Okay.
And that's how we're able to have these, like, super old things. And it's actually a very rich deposit there in Scotland of various organisms. But the preservation of the fungi is especially good. There's not a lot of really good, well-preserved fungal fossils out there. We don't know why. I mean, we've got some more recent stuff. There's things like coal balls, and actually very close to here, like on the island, there's a number of sites that have fossils, but they're only about, I think, 50 million years ago or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how are you sure that happened 400 million years ago?
You can date the samples.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then how are you sure that it happened at all? How do you know that it wasn't? Like you said, they didn't inherit it from theirs.
Oh, so you don't know, but you make inferences based on computer-based analyses of probability.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. So what we did is we had to find out, first of all, the relationships between the different organisms in question. And what we did was exactly what I trained you to do, which was to extract DNA from living things,
yeah,
and then amplify certain regions of their DNA that are representative of who they are. It's like if you had, it's almost like a barcode, right? Like if Adam had a distinct signature barcode, that represented Adam.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there would be a different one for me. But it's the same region in the genome for different fungi that represents... it's basically different for different species.
Okay.
But it's sort of not reliable, but it's something that is commonly used in the community that studies fungi to identify different species.
Basically changes in their DNA.
Yes, it's changes in their DNA. So a lot of your DNA, I mean, from different individuals and different species might actually be the same. So, for example, some protein in different species might do the same thing, so it might fundamental structure. Or there might be some difference, but it's not really consistent or detectable. Not necessarily. Anyways, it might not be consistent, in other words. And it might not be... Yes, things that are really important tend not to change.
Okay.
In other words. But in this particular gene region that we often study, it's not within a functional... The DNA encodes something that is not part of an important protein. So it tends to vary a lot.
Okay.
So you can detect different species this way because you can detect smaller changes on a more recent time scale.
All right.
Yes. And so that's one of the regions, but I also looked at other regions as well that tend to change more slowly. And with regions that change more slowly, you can kind of look at relationships that are deeper, so older relationships. So what I did is I inferred how the different fungi were related to each other using these sequences. And then I sort of mapped their physical characteristics onto this representation of their relationships. And so then you can sort of use likelihood models to guess, essentially, but with some support.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Certainty?
Pretty good, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, with anything that you can't see, you're never really sure.
Yeah, that's exactly where
I'm
at. Okay.
Yeah, so it's true, for sure. That's what it is with a lot of the science that we do. And if you think about it yourself, like, you know, when we make decisions about, you know, medication and whatnot, I mean, that's based on science that is supposed to be reproducible and all those things that say, you know, this must be true because we can do it again and again. But the fact is, a lot of times people don't do them again and again, and that's the case with a lot of research.
Dear.
So we do our best, I think. There's this process of peer review where people within a field will evaluate the research of others before it gets published to determine whether, you know, it seems sound and reproducible and all that stuff, and also to help them improve their work. We try and capture anything that might be false that way, but you can't catch everything, and sometimes papers get retracted. So, you know, later on people will find, hey, we couldn't reproduce this result. Are you sure that's real?
So you did that work. Did you have this moment of, like, eureka?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like,
so
wow,
it was like, wow, okay, there's the answer. That was the answer to the question that I had.
Cool.
And that's really cool.
And then you wrote it up.
And then I wrote it up.
And submitted it for publication.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did it get published?
Yeah.
In what paper?
The journal is called Mycologia. So
oh,
it's a journal
okay.
about fungi.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure our listeners will be familiar with
Mycologia. Oh, yes. Super.
And then did anybody get back and be like, guys, did anybody find any problems with
what you've done? No. So when we submitted it, I mean, there were things like, people always have suggestions as to how you can make it better. If you've been thoughtful enough about it, then there's probably not anything really severely wrong with it. Probably not. But not always. So what you'll do is you'll send it to the journal and you'll say, hey, look, this is what I found. Do you maybe want to publish it? And they'll say, well, yeah, that looks like something we'd be interested in. So they'll find some people in your field and they'll say, look, we got this paper. Could you look at it? Could you tell us what you think about it? And so they'll send it out to a bunch of people, like three people, or four people in your field, and they'll read it. and they'll evaluate it, mm-hmm. and then they'll give some comments. So they'll give some feedback, like, I think this is a really important piece of work, but it needs a little bit of something. So they'll say, well, this additional analysis needs to be done. This result wasn't clear. Can you make it more clear? Your sampling was not quite up to snuff. Maybe you could add these things. Mm-hmm. They might have a bunch of suggestions for tweaking this, that, or the other thing in your paper. And then they'll send it back to you, and you'll look at it, and you go, oh, that's a really good point, or, oh, that's ridiculous. Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
But after it was published, like, how was it received?
So actually, before it was published, I had presented some of the results at a conference, and people were interested in it already at that point. And in fact, I don't know how some of these other people found out about it, actually. I should have asked them, but they were also interested in it for other reasons, for not exactly the same reasons that I was doing the research, but for similar studies of their own, and they just wanted to kind of see the paper ahead of time.
That's amazing, because yeah. I don't want to sound harsh, but like, there are other people
yeah.
who actually care that
yeah.
these certain
no.
fungal
and that's
structures.
Exactly what it is. So that's the other thing. So when you discover something, it's really cool for yourself, but you kind of the research that just about most people, any sort of discovery-based research that isn't, like, applied to some, you know, ecological or, no, more like economical or medical problem is always kind of, you always have to feel like you have to justify what you're doing. Like, why are yeah. you so interested in this? Who cares about that,
yeah.
right? Who cares about the evolution of fungi? Well, I care, but it's true. Not a lot of other people probably do. But when there are other people who do, it's very exciting because
right.
there's this other person who is excited about what you're excited about that hardly anybody else is excited about, and it's very thrilling.
I can't believe it.
That's right? Awesome. Like, when you find out that some obscure band that you love, you know, your best friend,
yeah.
This person that you just met, is like, whoa, I love that band too. Like, it's just like that, you know? And nobody else knows about it but you two, but you can share that, and it's just very exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let me switch gears and ask you, what about, have you ever looked at something like radioactive fungi?
No.
What would happen if you were experimenting with radioactive fungi and, like, all of a sudden, like, inhaled a spore and you got superpowers? Is that in the realm of possibility?
That's a good question.
Okay.
I've never thought about it. So, radioactive fungi.
No?
I don't think – the fact is there's mutagens all around us all the time. And most mutations in the human body, I think, are harmless, but many are those that lead to cancer.
Uh-oh.
So I think cancer is a much more likely outcome of any sort of mutagenization
okay.
from – but I don't think a fungal spore would come and mutate your own DNA. That's
if we
not
could get
very
spores,
likely.
Okay.
I mean – usually, you know, if a spore gets into your – so every time you breathe in, actually, you probably breathe in 4 to 6 fungal spores. That's just
– really?
A fact. You're just breathing in them. As we speak, I'm breathing them in. You're breathing them in
okay.
a couple at a time.
Okay.
And the fact is they just kind of – you know, some of them are filtered out by the various things in your body, the natural defense systems in your nose and your throat. But some of them might get down to your lungs, and you have to be really unlucky for them to cause any problems. But, you know, if they were radioactive themselves, I don't think – you'd have to inhale quite a load of them for anything to happen.
Okay. Obviously, I'm basing most of my knowledge on
superhero
the origin
movies.
Of Spider-Man. It worked in that. Okay.
And so you'd have fungus-like powers.
Okay, wait. No, yeah. There's something yeah. you touched on that I really want to talk about. Okay, so you said that you can inhale and they can cause problems.
Yes. So people who are immune compromised
yeah.
can have problems from inhaling fungal spores. From fungi that are in the environment all the time that aren't necessarily disease-causing but can become problematic if you're immune-suppressed.
Let's just for our listeners try to identify some of the medical conditions that are caused by fungi,
okay.
not bacteria. Can
sure.
you think of any?
Yes, yes. So yeast infections.
Yeast infections,
so
okay.
the most common fungal infection that, you know, people probably encounter is a yeast infection.
Okay. Do you know
so
what drug they give for that? Do you know any antifungals?
What is it called? They're beta-lactams?
Yeah. Are those not for bacteria?
They might have other uses. But what these drugs do, I think that's what they are.
Oh, dear.
They basically interfere with the pathway that fungi use to create this chemical called ergosterol.
Okay.
And ergosterol is like cholesterol.
Yeah.
So in fungi, instead of cholesterol, they have this sterol chemical that's called ergosterol, and it's involved in like cholesterol, kind of maintaining a certain fluidity in the cell membrane.
Okay.
This might be getting way too technical.
That's
anyway,
okay.
So it's fungal specific though. So people don't make ergosterol. Plants don't make ergosterol.
So attack that. You're not.
Exactly.
Gonna hurt the host.
Exactly. But I mean, there is a little bit of interaction because ergosterol is so chemically similar.
Yeah.
To cholesterol, and fungi and animal, because they share a common ancestor, have similar pathways for creating these molecules. So a lot of drugs that are antifungal are actually quite bad for people because there is some interaction with human pathways with these drugs. So
just off the top of my head, like I know for yeast infections we give, they all end in azole?
Fluconazole? Fluconazole. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you think of, I guess that you just kind of answered with ergosterol, why like an antibiotic would not work against a
yes.
fungus?
Yes, because, I mean, it depends on the mode of action of antibiotics. Some antibiotics are given for fungal things, but I think that's a mistake some of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know another one is athlete's foot.
Yes, so athlete's foot.
Fungal infection.
Fungal infection.
All right. I know. Yeah. What about you said that people inhale in their lungs? I'm on the verge of saying tuberculosis.
No, tuberculosis is a bacteria.
Bacteria, okay.
Yeah.
And any fungal infection in the chest?
Yeah, so so generally if a person comes in, if a healthy person goes into the ER or whatever with a fungal problem of the respiratory tract, it's probably because they've just simply inhaled too many spores because they live in a basement that isn't dry enough.
Okay.
So basically people who live in moldy basements that are too humid, essentially. Humidity is very good for fungal growth. If you have a lot of mold growing in your living space, you could inhale a lot of spores. And just the sheer amount of spores is problematic. You can develop an allergy to it. And it's not because they're particularly disease-causing. Fungi are not really good at infecting humans in general, with the exception of things like athlete's foot and yeast infections.
Okay.
Because most fungi don't grow well at body temperature.
They like it warmer?
They like it cooler.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so your body is at 37. Most fungi don't like 37 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's your favorite fungi?
What is my favorite fungus? That's a really good question. I have no idea. You know what? I'm not really a person who generally has favorites of anything.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a least favorite?
Do I have a least favorite?
I can't name one. I can't even think of any fungus.
You can't even think of any fungus. Mycoplasma is also bacteria.
Would I know to hear the name of a fungus?
I mean, Saccharomyces. Do you know Saccharomyces?
Oh, it's sort of, yeah. Sort
yeah,
of
so Saccharomyces about. Is the brewer's yeast.
Okay.
So that's what we use to make bread and to make beer. And also, it's a huge model organism. So a lot of the research that people have done on the cell cycle, which is related to the proliferation of cancer, was done with yeast because it's very easily manipulated in the lab. And we've got the genome. We know so many things about yeast, and it's just easy to work with in the lab. So a lot of research is done, especially for things relating to
I will honestly choose that as
cell
my favorite
proliferation.
Fungus. What's it called?
Yeah.
Again?
Saccharomyces.
Saccharomyces.
Saccharomyces. Sugar fungus.
Oh, sugar fungus.
Yeah.
Okay. Saccharomyces. I'll take that.
Mm-hmm.
And no enemies? Aren't there any?
Enemies? Part of me doesn't like certain fungi because they cause human disease.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're also, when I see something, it's like a villain that's really clever. kind of almost respect it just
you
for being so crafty.
Respect, yeah,
right?
Such a formidable opponent.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
when you tip your hat to
I'll give you that.
Yeah. So things like Cryptococcus, which cause terrible brain lesions, actually. And I mean, it's a terrible fungus, but it's really cool what it does. I mean, not cool in a way. I shouldn't say that. But.
Is it possible for a fungus to not get obviously get into the brain and like form a lesion, but then sort of like to take over the thought? And,
so,
like...
that's interesting because actually there are fungi that colonize ants. Mm-hmm. That make what is called they're called the zombie ant fungus, something like that. They make zombie ants, so they infect ants and they cause them to climb up to really high places, and then they'll kill the ant, and then they'll produce this stalk where their spores are kept, and they'll basically take the opportunity of dragging that ant up really high so that it can get up high so that it can disperse as far as possible its spores.
So have you seen
how it
happen,
does that, I don't know. Oh, you can watch it on YouTube. Look it up.
Zombie ants fungus.
Yeah, just I can't remember what the order
that's
of those
fine,
words is.
That's fine. I'm
but
sure.
But zombie ant fungus attack. It's called cordyceps.
Unbelievable. Could that happen with humans? We might be. They, are we really sentient beings or not?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we're sentient.
Oh my gosh. Okay. There's so many things I want to talk about.
I mean, it would be very complex. The human brain is, like, we don't understand it very well, I don't think.
But theoretically, you could sort of inhibit a synaptic firing.
I guess, yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe stimulate it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. What do we have to learn from funguses? Fungi?
Fungi? Lots of stuff. I don't know. That's a really broad question.
What have you personally learned from fungi?
What have I personally... I mean... Things that I've directly researched in...
Yeah, but no, like a life lesson.
Life lesson? So,
that's a tough question.
It's nothing is irretrievably messed up.
Okay.
I was told... There's a much more...
That's good to know.
Profane way of saying it. I don't know. I had a talk with another very wonderful biologist from Berkeley the other week, and she has a motto, and that is, nothing is effed.
Really?
Yes.
Because that's in contrary to what I think. It seems like.
Really?
I don't get to look at the microcellular world, but like up here, everything is effed.
Oh, in the sense that when you make a mistake... yourself. It's not as if everything is lost.
Okay.
I think that's the lesson that I've
you.
Learned from fungi.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're running
and
out
working
of time.
With them. Yes.
And I really want to play a couple more songs, but
yes.
I want to ask you about, do you have any goals for the future of science or
Science?
Like what are
the
you working on
next? The
entire
future of science.
What's going on?
So it's a good question. I don't know. I'm going to finish up my PhD probably within the year.
Okay, congratulations.
Thanks. I hope so. things have to cooperate.
It's just more, boring, but like technical, fungi stuff?
Oh, well, yes. It's by now you shouldn't be thinking these are boring. I should have amazed you with fungal science.
Okay.
I have three different research projects basically mm-hmm. going, and it's just a matter of going through them.
What about the Nobel Prize?
The Nobel Prize.
Do you have a dream of like winning?
You know what? I don't. I think everybody would love to win a Nobel Prize, but I mean, that isn't my goal. And actually, people who win a Nobel Prize, I don't think that's usually their goal either.
Okay.
And a lot of discoveries that have led to those prizes, I think, for example, GFP, which is this really commonly used protein that, like, a lot of scientists use now, was this accidental discovery. This guy was, like, studying jellyfish,
mm-hmm.
and he just noticed that they had this protein that glowed, and everyone just jumped on it, and now it's used all the time for various applications. There's a lot of serendipity in science, and you don't have to be aiming at a Nobel Prize to win one. But at the same time, there are certain things that probably lend themselves better to that than what I do. But I mean, my goals are to contribute to the body of knowledge and to be a collaborator with others in doing that. And I hope to teach other people, like what I'm doing right now. I mean, I'm doing it because I want to share what I know about fungi and share my enthusiasm for them with people who might be listening and yourself. And that's what I hope to do.
That's awesome, Jackie. You sound like a real scientist.
Do I?
There's so many posers out there. Do you have aspirations like open your own lab? Do you think like, oh, what could I do?
Yeah. So, I've always had, because what got me into the fungi in the first place is kind of what keeps me going still. And I mean, pursuing some of those questions that I still have would be an awesome thing to do. Whether I would be able to do those things, I don't know. I mean, positions in academia are very competitive. But I hope to just continue and see where it goes and be true to what I enjoy and not try and weasel myself into something that because I think this is a good thing to go into or I think there's more money in this, but just to continue to follow my interests and see where that takes me.
Right on. That's exactly what science needs. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Are you still taking volunteers at the lab?
Yeah. They have to be like you. They have to be reliable. So we have volunteers. People will come in because they want to put something on their resume. But, you know, they'll show up twice and then never come again after you've invested all this time, like, coordinating
scientists.
With them and then teaching them stuff.
They're
and then they never show up again.
Own. Yeah. They don't even really care.
Yeah. So, but I mean, if there's people who are super interested in what we do in the lab, then they're welcome to come and talk to us. And, I mean, if they really want to spend the time to get to know what we do and to contribute to what we do, then they're welcome to come and join
us. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
DNA polymerase.
It's very cool.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us this week, Jackie. It was a total pleasure.
It was a pleasure.
All those listeners who are into real science out there, definitely check out Mary Burby's lab.
Yep.
And check the latest publications for Jackie D's newest discoveries. We're going to leave you with a little music. This is Knife Pleats. Thanks again for being with us, Jackie. And until next week, stay pharmaceutically aware and stay cool, radio fans. Transition state and transmission.